Welcome to the 11KPW podcast, an update on case law and legal developments under the Freedom of Information Act 2000 by Andrew Sharland. This talk was given at the 11KPW Information Law Conference on the 2nd of March 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to see such a large audience today. When I wrote my slides last week, I'd planned to talk about the following six topics. Recent Supreme Court judgment in Attorney General and Evans, also known as the Prince Charles Black Spider Memos case. Secondly, vexatious litigants, again. Thirdly, a couple of cases on the public interest balance. Fourthly, Colonzo Dunn and the Section 40 exemption. Fifthly, the recent Court of Appeal decision in Ipsia and copies of documents. And sixthly, a bit of crystal ball gazing about the future of freedom of information. And one of the future events I was going to talk about was the report from the Independent Commission on Freedom of Information. However, as Karen flagged up in a very helpful development yesterday, after I'd written both my slides and my talk, the government published its long-awaited and relatively lengthy report reviewing the workings of the Freedom of Information Act. So I've rewritten my talk. I'm going to take a number of topics more shortly than I initially planned, and I'm going to drop a couple of slides. I'm going to skip the Lewis and Colenso Dunn cases to spend more time discussing the Burns Commission recommendations and, importantly, the government's response to them insofar as we understand it. As a result of this change, I've had to cut all my jokes. This was going to be a hilarious talk that rivaled the great Stuart Lee, Eddie Izzard, and of course, 11KBW's Chris Knight. But they're all gone. But please don't mark me down in the feedback for that. Just work on the basis this was very funny and informative. So, to start, Evans. This is comfortably the most high-profile FOIA case of the year. However, I'm going to deal with it relatively briefly because the vast majority of you will not be advising on whether or not to issue a veto. And the minority of you that are advising on that issue, I doubt, are going to be that assisted by a five-minute summary from me when you're able to call on the likes of the Treasury Devil and other eminent silks to advise. I will, however, return to the issue of the veto when we discuss the Burns Commission report. Now, as I think a lot of you will be aware, Mr. Evans, the Guardian journalist, requested Prince Charles' letters to ministers and their responses in 2005. Departments refused to disclose them, invoking a number of exemptions. This refusal was upheld by the Information Commissioner. However, the Upper Tribunal, the case went straight to the Upper Tribunal, they reversed the Information Commissioner and concluded that these letters should be disclosed. Instead of appealing the Upper Tribunal's decision, the government vetoed the matter. The Attorney General issued a certificate under Section 53 stating that the departments had been entitled to refuse disclosure. Mr. Evans sought judicial review of the decision to issue the certificate. The Divisional Court dismissed that challenge, but the Court of Appeal allowed his appeal. The Attorney General appealed to the Supreme Court, and it came before the Supreme Court nearly a decade after the original request. Where a government department is served with a decision that a refusal to disclose is unlawful, then Section 53 allows an accountable person, essentially a minister, to serve a certificate within 20 days of the decision stating that he or she has, on reasonable grounds, formed the opinion that there was no contravention of FOIA. Such a certificate renders the original decision of no effect. The question that was before the Supreme Court is, what are reasonable grounds for such an opinion? The majority of the Supreme Court took the view that, given the extraordinary constitutional implications of Section 53, something very exceptional was required to permit a veto. If Parliament's intention was that a veto could be exercised merely because the accountable person disagreed with the court's view, then crystal clear language would be needed, and the Supreme Court held that Section 53 was not sufficiently crystal clear. Lord Wilson dissented, argued that the majority's enthusiasm for separation of powers had led them to essentially forget another equally important principle of parliamentary sovereignty. He was of the view that whilst an executive veto of a court's decision on a point of law would be unlawful, issues relating to the evaluation of the public interest are entirely different. As we shall see later, the Burns Commission sided very much with Lord Wilson's approach on this. What then are permissible grounds for a Section 53 veto? Lord Neuberger approved the formulation of the Court of Appeal that it would require, quote, a material change of circumstances since the tribunal decision, or that the decision of the tribunal was demonstrably flawed in fact or in law. Although an appeal might be the most obvious way to challenge a demonstrably flawed decision, Lord Neuberger held that there could be circumstances where new evidence or grounds came to the attention of the accountable person that could not found an appeal. Now for something completely different. We turn from, no doubt, the very helpful and constructive correspondence from Prince Charles, which ministers no doubt appreciated receiving, to Mr. Dransfield. Mr. Dransfield is a vexatious individual. Mr. Dransfield made a politely phrased and precise request for information about a pedestrian bridge and its lightning protection system. I'm sure you'll agree, a matter of great importance. However, the council treated this request as vexatious based on Mr. Dransfield's historic dealing with them, including a belligerent and accusatory behaviour. The upper tribunal held that vexatious meant manifestly unjustified, an inappropriate or an improper use of the Freedom of Information Act. They provide a lot of detailed guidance on how the concept of vexatiousness should be applied, and they stated that you must consider four matters. The burden that complying with the request would impose on the public authority, the likely motive of the requester, the value of the information sought, and the harassing effect of the request. Now, Mr. Dransfield obtained permission to appeal to the Court of Appeal. The only issue before the Court of Appeal was whether a request could be treated as vexatious if it itself was not vexatious, but previous requests had been. The Court of Appeal agreed with the Upper Tribunal that it could. Lady Justice Arden noted that the Upper Tribunal's guidance on the meaning of vexatious was not challenged. However, notwithstanding the narrow scope of the appeal and the fact that the guidance wasn't challenged, Lady Justice Arden, with whom the other two members of the court agreed, herself gave further guidance. The core passages are at paragraphs 68 to 72 of the judgment. She said that there's no comprehensive definition of vexatiousness, but the hurdle is high. It should not be too readily applied by public authorities. The focus should be on an objective standard. The starting point, not necessarily the finishing point, is that vexatiousness primarily involves making a request which has no reasonable foundation. There is no reasonable foundation for thinking that the information sought would be of value for the requester or the public or any section of the public. At paragraph 72, she sought to qualify a point made by the Upper Tribunal, where they said the purpose of Section 14 was to protect resources, in the broader sense of the word, of the authority from being squandered by disproportionate use of FOIA. She qualified that, saying this aim only comes up if the high standard set for vexatiousness is satisfied. Now, it's possible, it's unclear at the moment, that the Court of Appeal has set a slightly higher threshold for public bodies invoking the Section 14 than the Upper Tribunal. Mr. Dransfield was recently refused permission to go to the Supreme Court, so that's the end of the matter. But there is likely to be further lower tribunal decisions seeking to apply the recent Court of Appeal decision. The first-tier tribunal judgment in the Russell case perhaps provides some support for the view that the Court of Appeal judgment in Dransfield makes it harder to invoke Section 14. However, two cases are going to the Upper Tribunal on this issue, Parker and Jeffcott. So hopefully by next year's conference, we will have a final answer on what vexatious means. A few brief points. The APCA case again. When do you apply the public interest balancing test? The orthodox view was you apply the public interest balancing test at the time of the request or at the latest the time the public authority responds to the request. That view was doubted to an extent by the Upper Tribunal in Badger Trust, where they suggested there may be scope for applying the public interest balancing test at the time of the first tier tribunal hearing because it's carrying out a de novo consideration of the matter. And of course, when you carry out the public interest balance test, public interest balance test may have an outcome on the result, because what was a great public interest in withholding the information at one point may have receded by the time you get to the first tier tribunal a year or two later, potentially. The Upper Tribunal in ABCA confirmed the orthodox view, and they placed a lot of reliance on Lord Newburger's decision in Evans when reaching that. So I think that issue is dead. I'm going to skip the next couple of slides, but they do provide a degree of detail, and move on to the IPSA case. Applicants under FOIA often request disclosure of documents rather than information per se. Generally, it is assumed that such requests are misconceived as the right of access provided for under FOIA relates to information and not documents. However, the Court of Appeals judgment in IPSA makes clear that sometimes the two can be inextricably linked together. In IPSA, the issue was whether IPSA was obliged under FOIA to disclose copies of expenses receipts submitted by MPs. IPSA disclosed the information contained in the receipts, it typed it out, and provided all the information in the receipts, but the Court of Appeal held that copies of the receipts themselves ought to be disclosed, as the way in which the information is presented, the way in which the information was recorded in the receipt was itself a form of visual information which fell within the scope of Section 1 FOIA. So the Information Commissioner's decision notice was upheld. I think this potentially has some importance going forward. Now, moving on to what I described last week as the future, the Burns Commission and fees in the tribunal. It was the future when I wrote the slides, but it's now the past, albeit the very recent past. As I'm sure you're all aware, the reviews generated a lot of controversy. It's been suggested that it was an establishment stitch-up appointing MPs strongly opposed to FOIA to sit on the commission, Jack Straw MP and Michael Howard, or Lord Howard as now known. However, these fears appear to have been misconceived. Indeed, the Cabinet Office press release that was widely quoted in the media yesterday appears to suggest there will be, quote, no legal changes as a result of the review. That phrase, no legal changes, was put in quotation marks both by The Guardian and The Sun, so it must be true. This may perhaps come as a surprise to the Commission, who, when they published their report yesterday, made 21 recommendations, 16 of which they thought required legislation. So their year's hard work perhaps has not been hugely productive. I'm going to discuss what I think are the key recommendations, but before I come to those, I just want to read a passage from the Ford. The Commission states, "It is our conclusion that the Act is generally working well and that it has been one of a number of measures that have helped to change the culture of the public sector. It has enhanced openness and transparency. The Commission considers that there is no evidence that the Act needs to be radically altered or that the right of access to information needs to be restricted. In some areas, the Commission is persuaded that the right of access should be increased. More generally, the Commission would like to see a significant reduction in the delays in the process whereby, without good reason, requests can go unresolved for several years. We have not been persuaded that there are any convincing arguments in favour of charging fees for requests, and therefore we make no proposals for change in relation to such fees. So that's the broad summary of their view. Coming on to the core recommendations. Firstly, in relation to the time, the Commission recommends amending Section 10.3 of FOIA to provide a precise time limit for responding to requests. As I'm sure you're aware, at present, the basic time limit for responding to requests is 20 working days. But if the public authority is invoking a qualified exemption, in addition to those 20 working days, they're entitled to an additional reasonable amount of time. An unspecified limit, and it appears to the Commission that some public authorities have been taking far too much time to consider such cases. So the Commission has suggested that in addition to the standard 20 working day time limit, public authorities will be able to extend that by a further 20 working days and no more in cases of significant complexity or volume, or where there needs to be consultation of third parties prior to disclosure. Obviously, the next stage, if the public authority refuses to disclose the information, is to request an internal review. And FOIA doesn't provide for a precise time limit for that. It just has to be carried out within a reasonable time. Again, the Commission felt that that was being abused or not being applied sufficiently rigorously, and they recommend a 20 working day time for the internal review. Third recommendation is that for any public authority with 100 full-time employees or more, all requests and responses should be published. They shouldn't just be sent to the requester, they should be published. Moving on to the more substantive recommendations, the Commission made five recommendations relating to proposed amendments to Section 35 and Section 36 of FOIA. As I'm sure most of you are familiar, Section 35 currently provides a qualified exemption for information that relates to the formulation of government policy. It can only be invoked by central government departments and the Welsh Assembly government. Section 36, by contrast, concerns disclosure of information that would be prejudicial to the effective conduct of public affairs. Both are qualified exemptions, although Section 36 can be invoked broadly by all public authorities. Now, the review contains some quite interesting statistics on the success of Section 35 and Section 36. In 2015, when Section 35 was relied upon by a central government department or the Welsh Assembly, the Information Commissioner upheld that decision in full in 83% of the cases, so a very high success rate. This was an increase over the previous 3 years, where the average success rate had been about two-thirds. Public authorities were less successful in invoking Section 36. In 2015, only 57% of the occasions where it was invoked, the Information Commission dismissed the appeal, and that was broadly in line with the average over the last 5 years of 59%. The Commission was of the view that there was uncertainty as to the scope of Section 35 and how effectively it worked, and therefore proposed a number of amendments. There was, importantly, no suggestion that Section 35 or Section 36 should be made an absolute exemption. They both are to remain qualified exemptions, albeit the Commission have views on how the public interest balance should be carried out. In relation to the scope of Section 35.1, the Commission suggests replacing the current Section 35.1A, which exempts information that relates to, quote, the formulation or development of government policy, with an exemption that protects information which would, quote, disclose internal communications that relate to government policy. I think there's an intention to broaden Section 35.1A there. They also suggest expanding Section 35.1B to protect information that relates to collective cabinet decision making and the consequent repeal of Section 36.2A that currently deals with such matters. The Commission also make two recommendations as to the application of the public interest balance on Section 35. Firstly, they want the legislation to make it clear that the public interest in maintaining the exemption is not lessened merely because a decision has been taken. And secondly, that when carrying out the public interest determination under Section 35, legislation should state that regard shall be had to the public interest in the maintenance of collective responsibility for ministers and the need for free and frank exchange of views or advice for the purposes of deliberation. I'm not entirely sure how necessary that is. The importance of free and frank exchange of views is something that already is featured in public interest balancing on Section 35, but the Commission felt it wasn't sufficiently robust, apparently. Turning to Section 36, to be able to invoke Section 36, at present, a public authority needs a qualified person to provide a reasonable opinion that release would be likely to prejudice the effective conduct of public affairs. That's a broad summary. Requiring that opinion can cause delay whilst the opinion is sought and perhaps adds little. The Commission suggests abolishing this requirement and replace it with a requirement not in legislation but in the Code of Practice issued pursuant to Section 45 of the Act that the decision to invoke Section 36 must be taken by, quote, a senior manager. Four recommendations are made by the Commission in relation to the veto. It's quite clear that they were concerned by the Supreme Court's decision in Evans, and their recommendations seek to address that. They firstly say that the government should legislate to put beyond doubt that it has the power to exercise a veto over the release of information under the Act. Well, I'm not convinced that Evans said there is no power of veto. It's just a very limited power, but the Commission want this emphasised in legislation. Secondly, legislation should provide that where an accountable person takes a different view of the public interest balance, they can veto. This is very much in line with Lord Wilson's dissent in Evans. The third recommendation is that the veto should only be exercised to overturn a decision of the Information Commissioner as to the public interest balance. Appeal rights would then fall away and the veto could be challenged by way of judicial review. Having the veto at this stage overcomes the Supreme Court's concerns about the separation of powers doctrine and the importance of the executive not being able to overturn court decisions. The fourth recommendation in relation to the veto is if the Information Commission decides in the government's favour, but the requester appeals, the Commission suggests that the government should be able to veto to uphold the Information Commissioner's decision. The appeal rights would then fall away and you'd be left with the judicial review of the confirmatory veto. I'm going to come back to this issue when I talk about the government's response. A somewhat radical proposal, the Commission suggests getting rid of the right of appeal to the first-tier tribunal against decisions of the Information Commissioner. It suggests that there should be no full merits appeal, but there should be a right of appeal on a point of law direct to the upper tribunal. That is a pretty radical change. The next recommendation suggests that the government review Section 45. Section 45 of FOIA requires government to issue a code of practice in relation to providing guidance to public authorities on matters of practice. The Commission suggests that the government should look at Section 45 again to consider whether it's sufficiently wide to cover all the matters the government may wish to issue guidance on. The Commission in particular is unclear whether Section 45 provides the government with the power to issue guidance on the public interest balancing test for qualified exemptions because of its talk about guidance on practice. The Commission also suggests that the code itself should be reviewed because it's now 10 years old. Further, the Commission suggests that a code of practice should be issued on Section 14 and the use of vexatious requests. This was at the suggestion of the Information Commissioner, who thought that putting guidance on a statutory basis would reduce the risk to public authorities being overturned and that the ICO's guidance is less robust. And having statutory guidance in the Code of Practice on this issue would protect public authorities more. That was the view of the IC. Final recommendation is should review the level of funding for the Information Commissioner. I think the implication is that the Information Commissioner is not currently being well enough funded, and with the additional responsibilities proposed, that's only going to get worse. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the government's response yesterday in the media, the Act was working well, and therefore there will be no legal changes. However, Mr Hancock MP, the Cabinet Office Minister responsible for commissioning the report, yesterday made a written statement to Parliament that is more nuanced and sets out what is described as the government's preliminary views on the recommendations. The government endorses the suggestion that there should be no new fees to requests. In relation to the veto, Mr Hancock says that it will only be deployed after an information commission's decision to avoid issues of clashes with the courts. He went on to say, on the basis that this approach proves effective, we will not bring any legislation forward at this stage. Now, this could lead to a significant increase in the use of the veto power. If central government loses on a matter that it considers to be very important, why run the risk of an appeal process and possibly a full rehearing in front of the first-tier tribunal when you can veto it and then limit any challenge to essentially JR grounds in the administrative court? Government also indicated that it intends to issue a code of practice to deal with vexatious claims. So going back to the veto point at the moment, the government's proposal does not address a situation where the Information Commissioner sides with the government, but the requester appeals. That was the position in Evans. The Information Commissioner sided with the government on that. And at present, there is no scope for the government vetoing before the Information Commissioner's decision at that stage. There's no power to issue a confirmatory veto. At present, if the government wins before the IC, he's got to wait for an adverse decision by a tribunal before vetoing, and that, of course, has lots of problems, see the Supreme Court decision in Evans. There's no mention of Section 35 and Section 36 and the recommendations on those. There's no mention on changes to time limits for response. So that, in summary, is the Burns Commission report. The second recent development that I flagged up in this slide, the issue of fees in the general regulatory chamber of the first tier tribunal. There was a consultation by the Ministry of Justice on the proposal to introduce fees for all cases within the GRC. This would have included appeals against Information Commissioner's decision under FOIA. A decision was taken by the government to introduce in fees that do not, in cases that don't concern information rights, but to await the Commission, the Burns Commission's report before deciding what to do with fees in relation to information appeals. The Commission don't address this issue, and the government's response doesn't deal with it either. However, given the approach to not introducing fees for requests and the general mood music about the Act working well, perhaps the best bet, at least at the moment, is it's unlikely such fees are going to be introduced in the near future, but we will have to wait and see. Finally, the future European. The future of freedom of information in this country is not just subject to consideration in the domestic sphere. Late last year, the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights heard all submissions in the case of Bizottság v. Hungary, which covers very similar ground to the recent Supreme Court judgment in Kennedy against the Charity Commission. And depending on the outcome in Bizottság, this could have a profound impact on freedom of information in the UK. Regular attendees at the 11KBW FOIA conference will be very familiar with the Kennedy case, so we've been talking about it for years. In summary, the majority of the Supreme Court concluded that there was no Article 10 right to receive information. The basis of that conclusion was the Strasbourg jurisprudence was insufficiently clear to require this conclusion. In short, the Supreme Court were deeply unimpressed with a large number of chamber decisions on this issue. Mr. Kennedy applied to the European Court of Human Rights seeking to establish such a right. His case is likely to be heard in a few years. However, Bissetag is likely to determine the issue one way or the other because it's a grand chamber decision. The UK government intervened in support of Hungary's position, as did various NGOs. There was an oral hearing in November of last year, and judgment is awaited. We don't know what the court is going to decide, but the lesson one must take from this is you have to come back next year to find out what the court did decide. Thank you very much for listening.